God, I'm now ready that you have all me good and bad. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do thy bidding. What is the rest of it? No, it isn't. That's part of the third step prayer. Yeah, take everything that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. So you say that and you mean it. Now, what's God take away? What he wants to take away. So you may think that part of you should be taken away and God may find that useful. And I can't explain that to you, but I'm pretty confrontive most of the time, and God hasn't seen fit to remove that. Although I'm willing to not be confrontive, I just don't. Maybe that's not what I think it is. Maybe candid. Yeah, I treasure candor in other people because I treasure single agendas in other people. Really confusing to me to get together with somebody who's got six agendas. They never know what the hell one they're working on. Before I forget it, I want to talk a little bit about dependence. The book says that we place our dependence squarely upon God. Now, what's that got to do with? We were just waiting the break, we were talking about sponsorship. And some people sponsor from their egos. And that means that you will talk to them all the time, tell them precisely what you're doing. They will make your decisions for you. And they will essentially direct your life. You got a sponsor like that, get rid of them. They're sponsoring out of their ego. If the first thing your sponsor tells you is not, place your dependence squarely upon God, I'm just another drunk. They're doing you a disservice. The thing to remember here is that sponsors are not infallible. None of us are infallible. So if I place my dependence on some other drunk, I am a fool. If I ask them, you know what sponsors are? They're guides. And that means they're going to walk with you. And if you ask them questions about their experience, they will answer you and you can benefit from their experience. But my sponsor refuses to answer questions to me about how I should live. And when I call them up and say, tell me what to do, he'll say, pray about it and do what you think. Took me 2 years to figure that out. Because we'd have these long-winded conversations, and the last comment in those conversations was, why don't you pray about it and do what you think? And after 2 years of that, I finally figured out that we could have abbreviated that whole conversation and gone directly to that. Remember that our dependence is squarely upon God. And I'm not trying to take off on sponsors here. I just want you to know in no uncertain terms that sponsors are guides and that they can be extremely helpful and if their intent is good especially. But if you got one that's operating out of their ego, which is that they want to start telling you how to run your whole life, you may find that unfulfilling. And the one thing that you will not do in those circumstances is you will not learn to depend on God. And you will walk around in AA asking everybody what's the right thing to do when you ought to be out there testing the water and testing your intuitive thought to find out what you ought to be doing. Thank you. So the book says that we made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. We did it when we took inventory. If you write your inventory out of somebody's idiotic guide, you know, well-meaning people write little things you can put checks in. It's like filling out an order for, you know, it's like... it's like ordering a magazine, basically. I don't get it. I mean, if I don't see it with some degree of clarity, what's the point? So my opinion here, again, which is not worth anything, is that if it isn't in the big book, I don't want to do it. Now, that may be very close-minded in your view, but it saved my life. And as soon as I start doing something that somebody else designed, I start running into trouble. I think this program's perfect. I think it's God-inspired. And I think anybody that tries to put his thumbprint on here is doing us all a disservice. Okay? And I've been able to stay sober for a long time on the basis of believing that. And I'm inclined to think that if you take the same attitude, which is, I'm just going to do what it says, that you will get sober, you will stay sober, and you will help other people become sober. So we made this list. Now, it's not particularly difficult. The reason why you have a sponsor in this deal is so they can give you perspective and clarity. So we go ahead and we make this list of all these people we've harmed, and then the next thing that's important is that we write down the harm. Now, I thought I knew that. You know, well, I just harmed him and him and her and her and him and my sponsor, when I went to review it with him, because he made me review the ninth step with her, the eighth step with him, said, "Where's the harm?" And I said, "Well, I must have harmed him. I mean, I was around him." And he's going, "Whoa, you must be pretty powerful." I didn't harm all the people I was around. And I don't harm them by being next to them. And sometimes I harm them in ways that I may not understand, and I have to get some clarity. And there are a lot of situations that are garbaged up with my own emotions, and so I cannot get clarity or perspective about what the harm was. And that's why I sit down with my sponsor and say, "Here's what went on, here's what I think, what do you think?" And then we will come to a conclusion about who I've harmed, what the harm was, and how to take care of it. Now, the whole business, first of all, and let's just talk about writing the list. Most of our amends, a list will occur in our inventory, which is precisely why if you write it by someone else's design, you won't have that list. So you short yourself that way. So considering that we've done this inventory based on what the book says, and we have this list of people, we will find most of the harm that we have created in that. Now, we'll probably have to add some people to it. So we do that. And then we get clear on what the harm is, because my sponsor told me he didn't want me going out and bothering people about stuff that I made up. You know the part in the book about we can't differentiate the true from the false? That has to do with where we were and what we did, and all of a sudden, sometimes we tell ourselves the same lie so often we start believing it. Okay? And sometimes we think something happened and it didn't. And sometimes we hope something didn't happen and it did. So we go through there and we find harm in each one of those things, and then we become willing to go make amends to them if we don't harm them further by making the amend. How can you do that? How can you make harm by going to make amends? Huh? Classic example is messing with somebody else's spouse. "Well, I'm sorry, I was in bed with your wife." "And now that you know, I feel much better." Well, come on. You know, we just try and do the best we can. Some of our amends will appear to be insurmountable. Sometimes we have done things which we will create more harm by trying to amend You know, amend means to change, don't you? So we try and find a way to balance the books. This is about bringing everything back to even, okay? This isn't about overbalancing the books. So when the book talks about not bowing or scraping before anyone, they're right. We're not over there to be subservient. Do you understand? We don't go in there and go, beat me, I've been terrible. That isn't what this is about. The book describes our attitudes when we go into amends, and the way it describes it is calm, frank, and open. That means I'm not excited or agitated, if I can help it. Sometimes that's pretty tough in amends. That I'm clear, that I talk about the truth, I talk about what really happened, which is about being frank and about being open. One of the first things I do in every amend is say I'm an alcoholic, and this is part of the recovery process for me. And the book suggests that we do that. And I do what the book suggests. So we need to be calm, frank, and open, and then we go out and repair the damage. Now, sometimes, if we owed people money, you pay them back. If you've harmed them in some other manner, you try and make some sort of reparation for what you've done. You do whatever's necessary to balance the books. Sometimes people will ask you to do things that overbalance the books. If they're really not very unreasonable, I will generally do them because I'm the one that created the harm. And if they want a little more and it's not too offensive, I'll just go ahead and do it. If it way overbalances the books, I tell them that's unreasonable. And they went, well, you came here. And I went, yes, but that's unreasonable. Okay? So we go to these people in a helpful and forgiving spirit. And we are calm, frank, and open. And we do what we need to do. I know an awful lot of people that drank because they didn't finish their amends. And they did everything else that was asked of them. Now, I'll give you someone else's experience, but then this is a friend. Came to me and said, and the person I sponsor, he said, I can't make this amend. And I said, which one? And he said, well, I faked an accident when I was working on a construction company. And they spent $40,000. And he said, I screwed up my knee playing tag football. And then I faked an accident on the job. And I said, he said, I can't do it. And I said, why not? He said, because they'll take me to jail. And I said, well, should we take you to jail or we take you to the cemetery? And he said, okay, and he was terrified. This is a big, strong, this is a guy that you wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley before he got sober, okay? So he went back there and he went to this company and he said, I've harmed you. I faked an accident. You guys paid $40,000 to cover the medical expenses. I regret having done that, and I want to make it right. And the first thing out of this, when he called up and told these people he wanted to talk to him with a company that he had defrauded, they said, meet us here at such and such a time. And he was absolutely certain that the PD was going to be there. And he walked in, and it was the treasurer of the company and the president of the company. And when he said that he wanted to make it right, the treasurer looked at him, and he said, are you in a 12-step program? And he said, yes. And the treasurer said, okay, we're going to talk about what we're going to do, and you can come back tomorrow and we'll tell you. And this guy called me up and said, I got to go back tomorrow. And I know they're going to arrest me, and I know I'm going to wind up in the state penitentiary. And I said, you don't know anything. You know what you're afraid of. But the truth is that the hardest thing about trusting God is trusting God. And this is where you learn. You can't learn to trust God if you never learn to trust Him. If you don't take that chance, if you don't put yourself in a position of risk and allow God to pull you out of bad circumstances, you will never, ever learn to trust Him. So he went back the next day. And he was expecting the squad cars to be in front of the office, and there wasn't one. And he walked into this office, and the treasurer was standing in there, and he said, we've decided what to do. And this guy said, okay. And the treasurer said, we would like you to contribute $400 to a charity of our choice, and we want to see the receipt. Thank you very much. What the hell would have happened to this guy if he hadn't done that? See, it would have eaten his guts away until he lost his sobriety. But there's a thing in the fear inventory that talks about this. Men of faith have courage. Now, how much courage? All right? That's the question. If you're going to give me courage, give me so much that I can jump out this window and be unafraid. Okay? How much courage do you really get? Enough to get one foot in front of the other. That's it. There are some times when we have so little courage that it's almost impossible to move physically. But we have enough courage to move. And what we find is that God was there all along, and that all we had to do was act. This is a program of action. Faith without works is dead. If we don't get up and participate in this and do those things that we have been asked to do in spite of our fear, we will never overcome this. There is enormous freedom in doing this and having it work, because it does work. All right, so we go about the business of making amends. You have this list, and you have the harm, and you can arrange it in any order that you want, but you start at the top and you go to the bottom. And you just go through it in a business-like manner, and one day you will be absolutely free. No, you will not, as the book says, have to cross the street to avoid anyone, because you're clear. And that day is just outrageous. Anybody have any question about a man? Yeah.
I'm Troy, I'm at college.
That's right.
Yeah, I just got one question. Say if you heard you're a drug dealer. I feel like I'm making amends with the drug dealer. That gives him more money to buy more drugs to
right.
give to kids that are, you know, dangerously living.
Right.
I mean, should I give that to charity or should I make amends with that drug dealer?
Pray about it and do what you think. I'm not being a smart ass.
Well, I'm not thinking that way, but what if I, you know, gave it to charity? Would that be my amends taken care of?
If you think they're your amends, they are. I have heard that same question a dozen times. What about the money I owed my drug dealer? I know people who stole money from mafia figures, and they went back and made amends. And you know what the mafia guy told him? Hey, I love you. I see what you did. Give me the money back. Don't ever show up again. So So that's what he did. Okay. I had to go make amends. I was a bill collector on the north side of Chicago. As a 240-pound psychopath. And so what I used to do is, and I not only collected money for loan companies, I collected money for bad guys. And so I would go kick in somebody's door and chase them through their house and throw them up against the wall and just keep banging them off the wall until they figured out how they were going to get the money. And I didn't care if they had to go rob a 7-Eleven. I told them I'd be back in 20 minutes and they damn well better have it, or something ugly was going to happen to them. I had to go back and make amends to those people. That's fun. Oh, man. The first time I did that, I went in and I went, look, you know, you remember what I did. I just... I'm really sorry about that. I'm trying to live a different life today. And I want to do anything that's necessary to make that right. You know what that guy said to me? Stay the hell away from me. Oh, man. Yes. Wait. Just first Al and then Bob.
How do you know the difference between the alcoholic mind? Use intuitive thought.
Yes. 11 steps
gradually
become work part of the mind. Yes. How do you know the difference between intuitive and impulsive? I trust it. What Alan's asking is what's the difference between intuitive thought and impulsive thought or self-directed thought? I've been doing that for so long, I'm not sure of the answer. I know I trust those thoughts that come to me about what to do, even if they're weird. I mean, from my perspective. Or out of the ordinary. I also know when I'm just trying to get up on somebody. So I think that eventually is just that you can differentiate that over time. And that's from a perspective of today. And early on when I was trying to do that, I was making mistakes. But I came to trust what I thought. What Alan's talking about is part of living a spiritual life, and it's about part of trusting God. See, with it, the book says that for groups, the way God speaks to us is through a group conscience. Okay, but as individual, God speaks to us through our intuitive thought, which is essentially our sense of right and wrong. Okay, and sometimes you will feel compelled to go do something. And it'll be out of the ordinary or uncomfortable or something like that, and my inclination's to go do it. I was walking down the street in Los Angeles. And this bum walks by me. And I was compelled to give him money. And I'm talking about damn near everything I had in my pocket, which was several hundred bucks. And I said, excuse me, and he turned around and I said, here, this is for you. And then I walked away. But I couldn't keep walking because I was too damn curious. And so I turned around to see what he was up to. And he was on his knees like this. I don't know what that means. But I know it was right. And see, that's weird. Why would you do that? I don't know. Barking at people in meetings. If you feel compelled to do it, you'd go do it. And you learn how to trust this, and you see the effects of it. And you go, oh, that's why it happened. And God was just using me as an instrument. And that I've got my ego so wrapped up on the inside of this thing that I'm afraid to follow my intuition. But see, the more you do it, the more you learn to trust it. And then when you get one of these things that seems a little weird, you go do it anyway. And then you see the net result of it. It's always pretty astounding. And we get addicted to spiritual experiences. Go looking at them, okay? It's part of the spiritual world. It's almost like there's two worlds here, in my experience. One of them is the temporal world, where we get up in the morning and go to work. And the other is the spiritual world, where we go out and try and be of service to other people. And I'm very fortunate today because my business is helping inmates, 80% of which are alcoholics and drug addicts. And so my spiritual job and my regular job are the same. What a wonderful combination. So I had to be dragged into this business. And it's extremely successful today. And I kept denying it. I kept avoiding it. I kept thinking it was beneath my dignity. I kept thinking that I didn't want to do it because I'd been around enough people that were causing problems. And God kept saying, that's what I want you to do, Bob. And here's what happens. I go, no, sir. And he goes, go ahead, Bob. I really want you to do that. And you go, that's fine, but I don't. And he'll go, no, I'll make you do that, Bob. And I'll say, like hell you will. And he'll say, Bob, you let go of that, or I'll take it away from you. And I'll go, why don't you go bother somebody else? And then he will rip it from my bloody fingers. And he will give me something else. And 3 weeks later, I'll be going, this is wonderful. Boy, am I glad I let go of that. I didn't let go of it. It was wrenched from me. Okay? And you'll get those messages sometimes. I didn't want to work with convicts. I just didn't. It's like, no thanks. And God was saying, you wanted a really good business. And I'm in a business nobody else wants to be in. Okay? People know I get locked up in a room full of inmates. They go, I wouldn't do that. Actually, it's the safest place in the city. So that's what happens. Anybody else want to talk about amends? Let's talk. Go ahead.
Can I say something about it too?
Yes, please.
I was sober about 8 or 9 years. Company had fired me by 29th year, hired me back. I was trying to, I got to a point where I had to practice these principles best I could in all my affairs. I knew you guys back. There's no problem being fired me with my sponsor. A lot of problems with agreement, but not with firing. And now it was. And I started to question myself. Can you, imperfect guy, strive honestly in a perfect world, populate the guys that are quite human? I don't know. That's a question somebody would probably have to answer within himself. That's the question. And you live by principles, not right there. You want to identify some principles I can live by, from the other. That's why I got to. And I wrestled with the thing for a couple of weeks, and then I called my sponsor if the wrestling match was over. And he told me, you know what? We decided that yes, I'm going to quit this company in my 38th year. I retired, quit. Didn't know what I was going to do. I was 57 years old at the time. My sponsor said, well, you've made your mind. I said, yeah. He said, what made you decide? Fine. I said, I'll start praying next week. And we did. Well, I said, you ought to use the PS system. What do you mean, the praise stream? I had the intuitive thought at that point.
I was already in the worst position. federal revenue that type of side. What did you say?
Right. I'm familiar with that. Thank you. Tell me when you want a break. I don't know if you want to go. I don't know what you want to do. But. Huh? Right. Whatever you're comfortable with, and then we'll just kind of get the rest of the way through. You want to do that? Okay. Go ahead. Which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. You all understand that promises are at the end of the ninth step. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. At this point, that's our function. We want to become more understanding and we want to become more effective. We've entered the world of the spirit. The instructions on this step are continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, and when you see it, ask God at once to remove it. Now, you already know what that feels like because you learned what that feels like in inventory. Okay? We talk to someone about it, we make amends if we've harmed someone, and then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. The book says that we have ceased fighting anyone or anything. Give up. You know what one of the virtues of this thing is? Quit defending yourself. Do you know what? If you know who you are, you don't have to defend yourself. Because you chose it. Okay? I don't want to fight anyone or anything. Fighting takes too much energy. It does. Why would I want to fight anyway? We'll seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we will recoil from it as a hot flame. It's from a hot flame. Now, it's just, we react sanely and normally. Yeah, remember this is 10. And we will find that this has happened automatically. We got this new attitude toward liquor. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I become neutral about alcohol. What a blessing. I can look at it. For me, it's like looking at dog food. I don't have a dog.
Isn't it
We haven't even sworn off. Instead, the problem's been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. This is our experience, and this is how we react as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Now, I asked a guy one night, how long have you been sober? Actually, he was sober a year longer than I was. And he likes to go out and beat up people emotionally in AA meetings just to show off, show his knowledge. It's spiritual pride. I know more about this. I'm more spiritual. I do all this stuff. You're just an idiot. That's the kind of approach he has toward it. And I said, the book says that by this point in our program that we react sanely and normally. And because you don't act sanely and normally, I'm assuming you have the choice and have chosen not to. Boy, was he angry. And my belief is that by the time we have reached the 10th step, or engaged in the 10th step, that we can choose to be sane and normal. And I choose to be that. And I think if you're seeing people act in some manner that is contrary to that, that they have chosen something else. And when that's the case, I don't want to be around them. One of the beauties about knowing who you are and being able to pick your friends is that you don't have to pick vexatious people. Vexatious. Have you ever heard the term being vexed? Getting angry? Vexed. That's an old word. Abrasive, angry. Vexatious people are people who upset you. I don't want to be around people like that. Don't want to have any part of them. You know, I've got about six or eight people that I'm really close to, and I don't handle that very well. I try to, and I think that there are responsibilities in being someone's friend. But I do not allow those kinds of people around me. And one guy came up and he said, we really ought to hang around together because we're in the same business. And I said, no. And he said, why not? And I said, I have no interest in that at all. And he said, why not? And I said, I don't need to explain that either. And that was the end of the conversation. Some people will try and impose themselves on you. Why would you let them? Most of the people who try and impose on you want something from you. They want credibility. It's like someone getting you as a sponsor. So when someone comes up and says, who's your sponsor? They can flash you in front of them, and then people think you're actually doing the work. You know, I've seen so many people ask other people to be their sponsors so they could hide behind them. And then if the sponsor isn't on the ball, they don't hold their feet to the fire. And what's the point? I mean, I don't want to be someone's sponsor in name, because the only reason why I can think of being someone's sponsor is to guide them through the process. So we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, and when we see it, we ask God at once to remove it. You know how you do that? God, please remove this. I'm not kidding. Right? That's how you do that. People will go, well, I'm not sure how to go about that. Well, God, please remove this. Okay? And then you talk to someone about it. As I have mentioned on many occasions today, my life has been in some turmoil for the last year. I am tenth-stepping my backside off every day. I call people because I lack perspective. Well, I call up a friend. Actually, I called up a woman, and I said, my ex-wife has got her boyfriend fully engaged in my kid's life. Is that okay? Because I'm thinking I ought to go over there and kill him. And she goes, that's perfectly normal. If she is vitally interested in that relationship, she may want to make sure that the children see the same good side of this guy that she sees. And because she wants to spend a lot of time with the children and wants to spend a lot of time with him, it's pretty normal to try and arrange things for them to do together. Oh. I'll just hurt him a little. I lack perspective when I'm challenged by my own beliefs or by my circumstances. I have to have perspective or I'm liable to go off at right angles. And so I call these 10-step buddies. I would encourage each of you to have some. The arrangement is every time I call you, you will listen, unless there's some serious circumstances to the contrary. And every time you call me, I will listen on the same basis. And so I have 3 or 4 people that I do that to with. And they talk to me about what they're experiencing, and I talk to them about what I'm experiencing, and I have daily contact with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, even when I don't go to meetings. And for the most part, because they are uninvolved third parties, they have good perspective, something I don't have. And I have to test the water when I am involved in these kinds of difficult circumstances. Some people won't 10-step because they're afraid of what kind of impression it's going to leave on the person that they 10-step with. It's like being afraid to 5-step with your sponsor. What's the point? I'm not afraid to be open about anything in my life if I'm talking to someone who's done the work. Nothing. I don't hold secrets. I'm not afraid of how I look. I just am not. You know, if they don't like it, they'll tell me, and if they do like it, or whatever it is. That's not what it's about. 10-stepping is about, here's what I see, what do you see? 10-stepping is about clarity, and 10-stepping is about being here now. It's about get out of the past and get out of the future and get here now. And keep your eyes open and see what's going on. And keep your mind focused so you can see what you're up to. And if you see something you don't like, challenge it. But it's about participating in life vigorously. Everyone I've ever met in my life has potential way beyond their own comprehension. Including me. And these are people with skills and abilities that far exceed what they're involved in. And what they need is clarity and purpose to go do that. See, what you get out of learning the truth about yourself is the ability to challenge life. God didn't make us sober so we could sit in a corner with our thumb in our backside. God made us sober so we could go out and become active and effective human beings. And if you don't know what your skills are yet, you haven't tried enough stuff. And just because you haven't done it doesn't mean you can't do it. And if your life has been unproductive this far, it's because you're unwilling to go out there and participate. So you want to know what's really fun? Go challenge life. Get out in the middle of it and risk and see what you're capable of. And I will guarantee you that you're all capable of more than you can imagine. You know, part of the process this weekend for me and next week is I am rewriting all the goals in my life. You know why you have goals? Because if you don't have a target, you don't hit anything. Okay? If you don't have any goals, you wander around in life getting what's left over. And if you're sitting there believing that somehow because you're an alcoholic or you haven't achieved what you wanted to do so far, go out there and do it. What the hell are you afraid of? You afraid of looking bad? That's what most people are afraid of. I'll tell you the secret of the ages. Nobody's looking. They aren't. They're so caught up in their own stuff they can't see you. Make life an adventure. Truly make it an adventure. Go out there and try things that other people are so terrified of doing that they can't get one foot in front of the other. You know, I go out and start new businesses and start new projects, and people go, how do you do that? And I tell them, I just go do it. And they go, I can't imagine. Aren't you afraid? And you go, sometimes. And they go, well, then why do you do it? And I went, see if I can do it. You know, God gives us the ability to go do this thing, and then we cower in the corner. And if you found the truth in this and you've been through this process, which is you've all done all 12 steps just once, at least, you can go out and challenge life effectively, and you will amaze your friends by your courage and your production and your ability. So anyway, we watch for this stuff. And we know what that looks like because we learned it in inventory. And then we talk to someone about it, and we make amends if we've harmed someone. And then we do what's pivotal in the 10th step. And the pivotal point in the 10th step is to resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Resolutely, with emphasis, turn our thoughts to someone we can help. It does not say go help someone. It says think about helping them. And you go, well, that's kind of funny. Aren't you just supposed to go out there and help them? Maybe. But it says turn your thoughts to them. And the reason why we turn our thoughts to them is we automatically turn away from ourselves when we do it. Right? So we learn how to do that. 10 steps about being in the present moment. Okay? That's what it's about. And it's about getting out of self. And it's also about having a new relationship with alcohol. If the day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, someone would have said that I will become neutral about alcohol, I would have told them they were smoking some funny stuff. Because I have never been neutral about alcohol. And today I am neutral about alcohol. It just doesn't come up. Anybody want to talk about the 10th step? Yeah. The danger in this program is the resurgence of self. I can't kill it. I beat it senseless, but I can't kill it. And as a consequence, my ego rebounds. And over time, it will become powerful again. And that somehow have to find a way to deflate it, because my ego will kill me. So I'm in the camp that says that I am not so faultless in the 10-step process that I can catch everything I'm up to. And periodically what I need to do is I need to renew all this stuff. And the first thing I do is I go back to the first step. Now, well, I've been sober since 1973. What the hell do I need a first step for? First thing that I look at is, am I really an alcoholic? People go, oh God, I don't want to look at that. I've already decided that a long time ago. Don't even bring it up. Well, wait a minute. Do I today believe that I'm an alcoholic? Am I willing to believe that I'm not? That's dangerous, huh? Am I willing to believe that I am not an alcoholic and I have been deluding myself for 29 years? Yeah. Except there is overwhelming evidence to the contrary. And the fact that I somehow have metamorphosed from being an alcoholic to a non-alcoholic in this period of time is the height of absurdity. Doesn't happen. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. So I believe that I need to periodically deflate my ego. That I need to challenge what I believe. I pick up beliefs. I believe this. And you need to wear that stuff like a loose coat. Because the truth changes over time. The only truth that I've seen that is absolutely constant through my whole sobriety is God is. That's constant. That has never changed. Everything else is. 11's about discipline. I don't think many people do it. Talks about what we do at night when we review our day and whether we put more into it than we've taken out. You see right here in the book, see this? See where my book's worn out? Right on the 11th step. And that's because I read the instructions for years. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should have been discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving towards all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, because that would diminish our usefulness to others. Sometimes it's hard, if you had a day where you didn't do real well, to drift into worry, remorse, and morbid reflection. Oh, hell, I'll never get this right. I really screwed up. Da-da-da-da. It's useless. Okay? It's the best you could do today. So you try and do better tomorrow. After making our review, we ask for God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures can be taken. God, please forgive me. Show me what corrective measures should be taken. That's simple, right? On awakening, we think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Can't do that unless you got some plans. So I write those the night before. I write them the night before I go to bed. I write 10 or 12 things that I want to do tomorrow. You know, this is the best business procedure you can imagine, because you write down everything you want to do, and then the next day you have all these things to do, and what happens is essentially the net result of all of this, because the plans don't always work, is that you get up with a plan in the morning, which though the first thing you don't think is what the hell's going to happen today, and the second thing that happens is you are focused on what you want to do, you got targets, and you're out there doing them. As soon as you get up with an idea of what you're going to do, your anxiety level goes down about 50% when you have a plan, because otherwise you feel like you are subjected to whatever whim comes along during the day. You see? So you have this plan and you get up and you go do it as much as you can. And sometimes I don't get any of it done. And the day gets interrupted by other things, and that's fine. But I had a plan when I started. And sometimes I carry over because some of my plan for the day includes things I want to do every day. Something that's always on my 11-step list. Try to make someone's life better. Every day. Be happy. Now, why would you do that? Absolutely. You know what? I forget it's a choice. And so I get so damned intense that I forget that I can be happy. And I love to be happy, but I forget to do it. Carry the vision of God's will into all your activities. That's in the 10th step. So So sometimes you can segment your day out. And if you're driving to work, you say, during the time when I'm driving to work, I'm going to carry God's will into all my activities, the vision of God's will into all my activities, driving to work, whatever that means, which means I'm not going to get in somebody's face or give them the finger or whatever it is because I get cut off in traffic or whatever it is. I'm just going to try and carry the vision of God's will. And when I get to work, I will segment out another portion of my day and say, how do I carry the vision of God's will into what I'm doing here? And I try and keep that constant through the day. It's part of the 10th step. We consider our plans for the day. Sometimes I rewrite my plans in the morning because I think of extra stuff I want to do. That's fine. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. That's what you say, God. Please direct my thinking. Especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. We are not mindless automatons. We're not robots. We are in God's army, but God gave us brains to use. And one of the things, well, there's more about that. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. And thinking about the day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision. God, I just feel like a broken record. Please give me inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. A lot of people, when they get in these positions where they don't know what to do, they get hyper. God's going to tell you what to do. Just relax so you can hear it. Incidentally, in my experience, God doesn't whisper. If you're listening intently to hear some faint sound coming to you as a message from God, you're wasting your energy. God wants you to know something. I guarantee you, you're going to know it. We are often surprised how the right answers come, and we've tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. We've been talking about that for a while. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable that we're going to be inspired at all times. It implies that we're going to be inspired part of the time. And it also implies that as our experience grows, we will be inspired more of the time. We may pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. And I have. And, you know, you got to go through the process. It's like learning how to catch a football or anything else. You got to go out there and practice it to find out what it feels like. We usually conclude this period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others may be helped. We're careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us waste a lot of time doing that. So, there is a description of what we do in the evening as we retire, and what we do in the morning upon awakening. Now, I wake up wired. I mean, I don't need coffee. I wake up wired, and my inclination is to jump out of bed, and I won't let myself jump out of bed until I do the 11th step. That's the way I force myself to do it. This is about discipline. And the book says, in this way, God disciplined us. And then it talks about attitudes. Thy will, not mine, be done, and I'm not running the show anymore. I know a guy that had one of those little watches that beeped every hour. And every time that thing beeped, he said, Thy will, not mine, be done, and I'm not running the show anymore. just to remind himself what he was supposed to be thinking about. The book says we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. That's a wonderful exercise, and you can teach yourself to do it. And the way you do that, you know what agitated or doubtful feels like? You know, people make a lifestyle out of that. If I get agitated, I know what it feels like. It has to do with either emotionally or physically stepping back. Sometimes if I'm confronted, I'll do that. I'll just back up emotionally or physically and say, God, give me the right thought or action. I need to know what's going on here. Show me what's happening. Show me what to do. And I can do that in a matter of seconds. And your intuitive thought will tell you what to do most of the time. And it really is a good way to stay out of trouble. Because my inclination has always been, if somebody gets in my face, I get closer. And if you challenge me, I'll give you a good reason why that's a mistake. And that's not the right thing to do. You know, it's answering aggression with aggression. Not a very useful thing. So, I would be amazed if 10% of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous do that. And I don't know why that would come as any surprise to anyone in this room. It's like any other part of this program. There are enormous benefits in submitting to the process. There is clarity. This is understanding. There is effectiveness. There are all sorts of benefits to having done this. And I don't want to sell you on it. And none of us do this perfectly. It's almost a joke around my home group about how some of us fall off of that track every once in a while. And we stay off it. And we're usually driven back by some sort of problem. So I don't, as useful as it is, I don't see a lot of people doing it, and I would certainly encourage all of you to do it, and if you do it for a while, you see the benefit of having done it. So let's talk about 12. So we carry this message to other alcoholics. What message? What are you carrying? Huh? Yes. So you got this new person there, and you want to carry the message to him. Well, what do you say? Yep. What's the next one?
Are you done?
Right? And then what? Okay. You can say that any way that you can say that effectively. Okay? We each have a different way of approaching that, I suppose. You don't have to live that way. You don't have to feel that way. You don't ever have to drink again. And I can tell you that there are a lot of us in this room that were in as dire a straits as you are. And we don't drink anymore, and our lives have changed. And we would be willing to show you how to do that. Okay? But then you better know what you're doing. First thing you do is you sit them down and you explain the 12 steps to them. That's the first thing. And then you ask them if they want to do it. And if they do, here's the deal. Here's what I tell people, and you certainly can choose to tell people whatever you want. I tell them, this is the deal. I will guide you through this process, and I will teach you everything that I can teach you about what I know about this process in sobriety. Your responsibility is to show up on time, every time. My responsibility is to be available each time that you show up, if you continue to do that. So if you maintain your interest and you have agreed to do this and you show up without fail, I will try with every fiber of my being to help you get sober. If at some point you lose interest, I'm out of here. If at some time you change your mind, I'm gone. My life is full. I have wonderful things to do with my kids. But I will take time away from a busy life to help save your life if you're willing to do it. And as soon as you lose interest, all deals are off. Now, one of the things that I do that other people don't do sometimes is I tell them, this is the other thing that you need to understand. If you ever, ever take a drink while I'm sponsoring you, I will never, ever sponsor you again. Oh, my. You know why? You know, in the doctors, and I can't remember, in the front of the book there somewhere, it talks about people seeing other people drinking, and then it says drinking with impunity. Alcoholics, we all think that we can operate with impunity. Impunity means without consequence. And what I'm telling these people is, you may think there are no consequences, but the consequence that you can count on as sure as the seasons is that I will never ever sponsor you again under any circumstances. And that may not be a big thing to you, but if you choose to drink, you can guarantee that that's going to happen. Okay? That's the deal. And then we sit down and we start at the forward to the first edition and we do everything, and sometimes I do it right with them. And I will stay there hell or high water till they're done. And that's my responsibility. I think that practicing spiritual principles in all our affairs is difficult. Sometimes it's just too easy to take advantage of people. And sometimes it looks like a good deal and it's not. And sometimes we have these opportunities to get over on people. And that's not the right thing to do. And if I am truly living a spiritual life, my sole responsibility is to do something that will improve the life of that person and help them recover from alcoholism. That's my responsibility. I have been given the gift of clarity about this program, and it is my responsibility to communicate that clearly with the people that I help. You have a choice about how engaged in this you want to be. It scares me when the book says half measures availed us nothing, because ideally they would avail us half. But it says if you only do it half-assed, you don't get anything. Okay? So it means I have to be fully engaged. If I am fully engaged, an awful lot of questions come up. And the questions have to do with, who am I really? What has God got in mind for me? What am I capable of? What are my talents? How far can I carry this? Does it work in business? Does it work in relationships? Does it work in every area of my life? Spiritual life isn't a theory. We got to live the spiritual life. And that means we take this into every area of our life, even when it's difficult. It's most difficult in relationships, in my experience. And if we get knocked down, we get up. And if you think that you're going to go sliding through this like it's some kind of happy time, you're wrong. You are going to face life's difficulties whether you like it or not. The trick is you will come through it unscathed. We have this enormous opportunity to be part of the legions of God. And God will give us the ability to become things that we never dreamed of. You all know who you'd like to be. You all have dreams. You want to go chase them? You can do it with a clear mind. You can do them with God on your side. And God will generally give you things that are better than anything you've ever asked for. What are you going to do? What kind of message are you going to carry? You going to stand up for yourself? You going to stand up for this program? You going to practice what you preach? What do you stand for? What are you going to do? You got the courage to go do this? I hope so. Think about it. Thanks a lot. I'm glad you were here because I'm really happy I was here.